I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Candidate Barack Obama vowed that if he was elected president, he would close the military prison at Guantanamo Bay and stop waterboarding and other harsh interrogations. Asked about those controversial practices at a press conference in August 2014, President Obama used the word torture.
Even before I came into office, I was very clear that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we did some things that were wrong. We did a whole lot of things that were right, but we tortured some folks. We did some things that were contrary to our values.
Our guest Sherry Fink has been writing about the long-term psychological effects of the mistreatment of detainees at Guantanamo and CIA secret prisons for the New York Times, where she is a correspondent. Prisoners subjected to beatings, stress positions, water drowning, death threats, being locked in coffin-like boxes, sleep deprivation, and more, have suffered from a variety of psychological problems. That was something that government lawyers and intelligence officials did not anticipate. Well, we wanted to know more, and Sherry Fink, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you.
President Obama used the word torture. He has used that word in other instances as well. Some say this is enhanced interrogation techniques. Some call it coercive questioning. Does it matter what we call what we're going to be talking about?
Well, I think it does matter, but you know, as journalists, we often just try to describe things. So we're talking here about techniques like so-called waterboarding, which is a technique, so to speak, that causes somebody to feel like they're drowning. It had been used in training exercises for U.S. military, so-called survival school, to kind of, you know, in very controlled settings. But it was used to mimic what might happen to one of our soldiers if our soldiers were captured by a regime that didn't respect the Geneva Conventions, that violated the laws of war, that tortured people. So those techniques were then re-engineered and applied to detainees in our prisons, CIA prisons in particular.
Well, and you write both about these secret CIA prisons, which have been around the world, and also at what has happened in the past at Guantanamo. Is it that what was being done in these CIA secret prisons kind of migrated to Guantanamo?
Well, there were things going on in parallel. So, yes, there were a couple of psychologists who were contractors for the CIA who have sort of been credited for or blamed for reengineering those techniques. They were hired by the CIA. They brought this set of quote-unquote techniques, including the waterboarding, but also things like pushing men into flexible walls, holding them in coffin-like boxes, forcing them to stand for prolonged periods, depriving them of sleep. And these contractors suggested that these kinds of methods would reduce the resistance of men who didn't want to share their secrets, so, you know, suspected terrorists. And so at the same time, when we think about Guantanamo, for example, there were other mental health professionals who were asked to kind of come up with a list of techniques similar based on that survival school that I mentioned for use at Guantanamo. And some of the more extreme techniques were used on at least a couple of men there. And then many people were subjected to, you know, part of that list, not including waterboarding, but some of the other really, really, you know, painful, stressful techniques, and not just one of them per man, but a combination of them together.
And I do want to talk about some of the prisoners that you write about. These two psychologists, Drs. Mitchell and Jessen, and the technique, or I guess the psychological theory that they were using or that they suggested using, is called learned helplessness. It's actually a theory by a University of Pennsylvania psychologist, Martin Seligman, but the idea of creating a situation of learned helplessness.
This is the idea that if you, it was, the experiments were done in dogs, and the idea that I think what they did was they used electrical, sort of like the electrocution of the dogs, or electrical shocks, I should say, and they just forced the dogs to realize that no matter what they did, they would still keep getting shocked. And so this concept is learned helplessness. Basically, they're helpless. There's nothing they can do. And so the theory was that if you did that to men, made them feel just totally helpless, that would somehow break down their resistance and they would spill their secrets. Of course, there was, you know, not really good evidence of that. And it would be really illegal to test torture, to study it as a medical experiment. There are some people who feel that was done. But in essence, that was what they were trying to do, or saying that their techniques would do.
And even a deeper complicating factor, as you write, a number of these prisoners or detainees were innocent. Some were detained or captured and held based on flimsy evidence or mistaken identity. Do we know how many people who have been detained, whether in these secret sites or at Guantanamo, were innocent, in a sense, innocent of the whatever charges were against them? And of course, many of them never actually directly charged.
Yeah, the vast majority of them never charged. And so I think there are a couple of issues. One is that it's very hard to know for sure much, because a lot of the evidence is still, or if there was evidence, is still under wraps. It's secret. It's not been released. But certainly there is evidence that many of the people who were held were not big fish, so to speak. And, one metric of that is that the majority of the people who were detained under the Bush administration, and the majority of the men who were released were also released. Hundreds of prisoners were released under President Bush without charges, found not to be a threat to national security, or assessed not to be a threat. So the vast, vast majority of people have been released. There are only 59 still being held at Guantanamo now. We understand that perhaps 17 or 18 of them should be released before the administration is the Obama administration is finished. So, as far as we can tell, a lot of these men were not masterminds, and certainly some of them seem to have been entirely innocent, were wrong place, wrong time. One really good source of information with regard to the CIA detainees, so these were men who were held in so-called secret black sites that were later outlawed or shut down, and the Senate did something that is colloquially known as the Senate Torture Report. There's been a lot of news recently, in recent days, a lot of op-eds being written, that this report, which was partially declassified, that the executive summary, which is like the size of a book, you can buy it, was partially declassified and released in 2014. And it has many, many details, very disturbing details about what happened. And some are calling for the entire report to be released before the president leaves office. Unlikely that will happen, but in that report is information that the people who put that together painstakingly with the CIA's own records over many years, I think millions of documents, believe that this is really important for our leaders to know about, so that things like violations of wars and American law the laws of war and American law will not happen again.
Well, let me quote from one of your stories, and this is about a businessman in Tanzania, a man named Mohammed Abdullah Saleh Al-Assad. He was snatched. He was held in a CIA, one of these secret sites, and apparently he was interrogated in isolation. There were sexual taunts, forced nudity, aggressive body cavity searches. He was kept in diapers. Can you tell us more about this man who, as you wrote, he died in May?
Well, there are many who underwent really similar types of treatment. And I think one of my colleagues may have written about him in particular, but I was able to, I mean, this was kind of the extraordinary thing for all of us who worked on this series, was to sit face-to-face with some of these men who have been released, who the U.S. didn't see fit to charge, and who had been through some of this. So I sat with a Libyan man who had been through some very similar things. He was also, he's not one of the official waterboarded people, but he was essentially subjected to something similar, where he felt like he was drowning, water was poured over his face, he was chained to a wall with all four limbs, really uncomfortable positions, forced to stand. Loud music was played for him, played in his cell, and now he can't hear the sound of that type of music without having flashbacks. So a lot of these men went through pretty horrific stuff and are left with the psychological and sometimes physical impact of what they went through at that time. So as you said at the beginning, the legal justification for doing this in the beginning, there were a series of memos from government lawyers, senior government lawyers, saying we can do these things. And part of the justification was that, you know, for it to be torture, it would have to cause lasting harm. And so they argued that these types of techniques would not cause lasting harm. And what my colleagues and I did over 6 months was to try to find these men and test that theory.
Well, but it seems to me that, and we're about a minute away from our first break here, but it's kind of basic psychology that if you do the things that are described in the series that you have been writing, and especially if someone is innocent or falsely accused, there are going to be psychological effects. It just seems kind of basic understanding about human nature.
Yeah, it does seem obvious, and we could only have to look at the experiences of American service people who had been subjected to torture or some of these similar techniques to see that indeed there are lasting effects. It seems obvious, but since our government had claimed that it wouldn't happen, we thought it would be very important to go out and test that.
And what was it like to sit across from someone and talk about their experiences? Again, we're almost up on a break, Sherry.
Yeah, just, thinking about the fact that my government had done that, and yet this man was willing to speak with me and trust that other Americans didn't necessarily, weren't necessarily involved. And, that's a lot of trust and a lot of re-experiencing of trauma to do that. But he felt it was important to share that.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation with Sherry Fink. She's a correspondent for The New York Times, and she and her colleagues have been writing about the long-term psychological effects of the treatment or mistreatment of detainees held at Guantanamo Bay, also at CIA secret prisons. We're going to talk much more after a very short break. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with Sherry Fink from The New York Times about the long-term psychological effects of harsh interrogation, even torture, on detainees held at Guantanamo and also at CIA secret sites. Sherry, one of the people that you talked to was a retired Brigadier General Stephen Zanakis, military psychiatrist. He interviewed a child soldier, I believe, Omar Khadr. He had also interviewed American POWs from the Vietnam War. And he saw some similarities between some of the detainees of this current war and also of the war in Vietnam. Can you tell us a little bit more about him?
Yeah, so Dr. Zanakis, I think, has probably examined the most detainees of any other psychologist or psychiatrist. And he's a former military psychiatrist and has worked or consulted with the defense teams of these men. And so he's gone to Guantanamo. He has spent hours and hours building trust with them and doing, you know, psychiatric examinations. And yes, indeed, he, you know, coming out of the military and then looking at the history of basically torture survivors around the world, he has seen a lot of similarities with the kinds of lasting effects that the treatment that our detainees have gone through caused. And so these are things like, you know, I guess the most prevalent is probably the disturbed sleep. Mm-hmm. And then it goes from there to flashbacks, like a lot of physical symptoms. They call it Gitmo belly, a lot of people colloquially, but this is just persistent gastrointestinal problems with digesting your food. There are, you know, some of the men have clinical depression. Some of them have clinical anxiety disorders. And so he's just documented a range of these problems. And PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, which he has seen in a lot of the men. The key here is that he has made the argument, and so have other mental health professionals working with these defense teams, that the men just aren't getting the care they need to recover from what they went through.
Well, let's talk a bit more about Guantanamo. And as you and your colleagues write, there were two, and perhaps still are, two kind of mental health teams at Guantanamo. One seemed to be made up largely of psychiatrists, and then a group called Behavioral Science Consultation Team, which seemed like it was made up largely of psychologists, also known as BISCIT. Were there different approaches then to detainees, depending on whether you were a psychiatrist or whether you were a psychologist?
Well, it has to do with it did end up being mostly the psychologists who were part of the BISCIT, so-called. But there were a few psychiatrists, too. It had to do in part with what the professional organizations that are kind of the main groups that set the standards for those professions in our country, what they kind of what their preferences or standards were. And so psychiatry that is overseeing psychiatrists in the U.S. or the main membership body for them, they very early on forbid psychiatrists from participating in interrogations, essentially. And so I think that's why psychologists ended up being the BISCITs. And just for people who don't know, who may be listening, what is that role? Well, that role was a mental health professional whose job was not to treat the detainees for any of those symptoms that I mentioned, but their role was to observe interrogation. Sometimes they were actually involved in interrogations in the early days and give input on, you know, gaining information from the suspected terrorist or the person who was being held. And some people have argued that that role was really unethical, particularly when those techniques that we're talking about were being used. So that is the BISCIT, the sort of operational rather than a therapeutic role. And there are many in the professions who would argue that once you're a health professional, you're a health professional, and you shouldn't be crossing that line. Early on, there were people, you know, there were very few rules, and it was very disturbing for the mental health profession in the U.S. because there were, at times, people who crossed those lines who were both so-called, you know, treating patients as well as questioning them and being involved in their questioning.
One of the justifications I've heard from people who justify the use of psychologists this way was to make sure that whoever was doing the interrogation didn't go too far. Is there evidence that they stepped in under those circumstances, Sherry? Do we know?
So I spoke with a number of the people who were in that BISCIT role, and they did say that they found themselves putting the brakes on some of the more extreme behaviors. And they told me, you know, early on, the people who were doing the interrogations were just these people who had very little experience even interviewing people. And so they found themselves in the role of helping them ask questions and sometimes trying to pull them out of a room. The interrogators and these young, untrained or not well-trained people, according to them, and trying to defuse a situation. Because we talked about those so-called, you know, enhanced interrogation techniques, and there was a list of them, and it was sort of officially approved by our government lawyers. But then there's also, once you open the, I guess, you know, you allow people to do those things, there's also the danger that it goes even further, or that there are other types of abuse. And some people may have heard of the Stanford Prison Experiment that was done a long time ago, which just showed that when you have people in control of other people, abuses can start. So some of these biscuits said, you know, I felt like I was actually stopping some bad behavior.
Let me quote something else from these series of articles. A Dr. Stewart, a Navy captain who treated detainees in 2003 and 2004, said she had never noticed any men in distress after returning from interrogations, but she typically did not ask what had happened there or try to focus on trauma and therapy. She said, quote, I didn't want to stir anything up that might make things worse. I underscored that. I mean, there's a part of sort of don't ask, don't tell of that, but also, I guess, a fear that if she intervened, a detainee might pay the price for her asking questions.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a whole story that we did. It's called, if people want to go to nytimes.com and put in classified nightmares, a whole story about the mental health care side of things. So these were the psychiatrists and psychologists whose mission was purely to treat men, and sometimes treat men who were mistreated by their own colleagues in the mental health profession. And so somehow they had to, you know, build trust with these people and these detainees and try to assess what was happening with them and why they were disturbed and why they were suffering. And what I found in speaking to about two dozen of these mental health professionals was that very often they weren't doing a full history. They weren't asking about what was happening behind those closed doors and the separate areas where interrogations were taking place. Part of it was that they never suspected, some of them early on, before all of this news came out about what was happening, they never suspected that the U.S. would be mistreating people. But part of it was that they, for various reasons, sometimes they were directly told, you're not allowed to ask about that. You're not allowed to ask about what's happening or what happened to that person when they were held in the CIA prison, when they were being interrogated at Guantanamo. And so many have argued, particularly outside psychologists and psychiatrists, that that is really inappropriate care, that how can you possibly address PTSD, post-traumatic stress, if you can't speak with the detainee, the patient, about what happened to them?
And that's Sherry Fink. She's a correspondent for The New York Times. And we're talking about a series of stories that she and her colleagues have been writing over the last couple of months about the treatment or mistreatment of detainees at places like Guantanamo Bay and also in CIA secret sites. And again, if you want to join our conversation, any questions or comments, 1-888-477-9499. Email radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Stu: I'm more worried what the normalization of torture has done to and will continue to the morals of our country. That they have the nerve to say that they're doing it in our name is infuriating. And I don't know if you share some of that, Sherry, or not, but it's, and I also think that there's, you know, we also, as a country, there's a kind of a don't ask, don't tell approach to a lot of this stuff as well, which is we've it's been 15 years, and I think there's a feeling of let's move on, let's not do what we did, and let's kind of close the door on this chapter in our history. You think that's a mistake?
You know, it is really hard for people to look at what's happened, to read stories, to listen to radio programs.
It is. I get it.
But yeah, I get it too. Boy, people are going through all sorts of things. There's all sorts of news happening, but this is important. This is really important, and we see that it's very relevant. There are still men at Guantanamo. There are big questions about what the next administration will choose to do with somebody who may be a terrorism suspect. And it is really, really important for us to be fully aware as a country of what was done, what the impact was, not only on the detainees, but on our own service members. Some of those psychiatrists and psychologists we were just talking about, they're still traumatized from having served in some of these missions. I was told by service members, psychiatrists, psychologists, others, that it was their most difficult mission was, you know, providing mental health care at Guantanamo. These were people who had deployed to war zones. So putting our service members in these positions also has a cost. And so I think it is really, really important for us to look at that as, you know, new policies, new laws are being contemplated.
You know, we have a caller. I'm going to get him on, Bill, from Wilmington with a question related to just what you were talking about there, Sherry. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty and guests. I've often wondered about the long-term mental effects for the people that are actually doing the torturing. I mean, how do they waterboard someone or put someone in a stressful position or beat someone and then just go home and have dinner and play with the kids? And I'll listen off the air.
Sure, Bill. Thanks for the call. You were talking about this, Sherry, and I wonder, have you looked at the long-term effects? Because in many ways, your series of stories looks at the long-term effects on detainees.
Yes, there has been some work on that. For example, one that comes to mind is, I think there was a study of Guantanamo guards. So these aren't necessarily people waterboarding people, but just participating in a very difficult situation down in Guantanamo. And I believe that it showed that they have had higher suicide rates than other service members. Now, I can't remember the exact details of that, but certainly there have been some anecdotal reports. I believe another news organization did do a story about that this year. And it is certainly true that, and I believe some of the people who were involved have written about that experience of having participated in some of these types of techniques or the treatment of detainees and then having long-term effects themselves.
You mentioned
it's a great question.
Yeah, thanks, Bill, for calling into Radio Times. You mentioned this Libyan that you had interviewed, Mohammed Ben Saud. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah, actually, I interviewed several. The person who I interviewed face-to-face was a different Khalid with his name. But Mohammed, yes, we spent a lot of time on Skype together. So the two men essentially went through something very similar.
And this Libyan that I just mentioned, there are several lawsuits. I guess they're in, federal courts against these two psychologists, Mitchell and Jessen. What's the status of that?
So that lawsuit in particular, and then there are several lawsuits afoot, but this particular lawsuit is out in Washington State and has gone further than anybody expected. It is attempting to hold these two contractors. They were psychologists, CIA contractors, who we were speaking about at the start of the hour, who helped to craft these techniques, the use of waterboarding and all of the, walling, pushing people into walls, the forced standing, et cetera, that whole regime of techniques that ended up being approved by our government. And they also participated in administering those techniques on detainees. And the detainees, some of them, including Mohammed Ben Saud, who you spoke of, are suing them in federal court. And, of course, people who were directly employed by the CIA, who are CIA members, may be covered under some government protections from being sued.
Sovereign immunity.
I believe that's the word. Not a lawyer.
Sovereign immunity, I believe. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. So the argument here is that since these were contractors, that they weren't necessarily covered by that. And the judge has allowed the case to go forward so far. The men, the psychologists, have had to respond to questions. And the judge has even approved of the depositions of senior CIA officials. Mm-hmm. So we'll see where that goes. But it's a very interesting case that we're keeping our eyes on. We wrote about it a couple weeks ago.
Let me get Maureen to join us. Maureen from New Jersey. Go ahead. You're on radio. Radio Times.
Hi, I have a question. There was a Pentagon press release about non-lethal devices being used at Gitmo, and I want to know what you know about these non-lethal devices and how they affect people. They, from what I know, they cause pain. They don't really show any bruises or any cuts.
Sherry, can you answer Maureen's question?
I'm really not sure what that is, although I will say that there's one detainee at Guantanamo. He's one of the so-called high-value detainees. These are people who were really, that there's, you know, strong evidence that they were involved in terror attacks like 9/11 or the Cole bombing. And there's one, his name is, the short version of his name is Ramzi bin al-Shib, who we did a little, if you go again to nytimes.com and pull up our series, which is, I think, called Lasting Scars, you can see his medical records, little excerpts of them, and how he's experienced psychosis, or you know, that's what the health professionals have diagnosed him with. And so very serious mental health problems. But he has consistently and in court claimed that he is being, you know, that there are certain vibrations are being used in his cell. And, you know, there's been no evidence that that is the case aside from his allegations. But there are certainly, maybe you're speaking of that, just some allegations that have been made about ways that men are continuing to be stressed there. But I don't know exactly what the one that you're referring to, that the caller's referring to.
Well, Sherry, we have to say goodbye to you, and I thank you for joining us today in Radio Times. Hopefully you and your colleagues will continue your reporting.
Thanks so much.
And she is a correspondent at The New York Times. We have Karen Greenberg waiting in the wings. She's the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Back in 2008, President-elect Barack Obama spoke with 60 Minutes' Steve Croft about his promise to close the military detention facility at Guantanamo Bay.
There are a number of different things that you could do early pertaining to executive orders.
Right.
One of them is to shut down Guantanamo Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Another is to change interrogation methods that are used by U.S. troops. Are those things that you plan to take early action on?
Yes. I have said repeatedly that I intend to close Guantanamo, and I will follow through on that. I've said repeatedly that America doesn't torture, and I'm going to make sure that we don't torture. Those are part and parcel of an effort to regain America's moral stature in the world.
Guantanamo remains open, holding 59 detainees while the harsh interrogations have stopped. Our guest Karen Greenberg has been writing about Guantanamo, terrorism, and national security. Her latest book is called Rogue Justice, and she's director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. And Karen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Very nice to be here.
That was a much younger president-elect Barack Obama talking about closing Guantanamo. Of course, it's still open. Do you think the president could have done more to close down Guantanamo?
I think even the president may think that he could have done more. I think a lot of the pace, the slow pace at the very beginning, really hindered him. It was 2 years into his presidency when Congress placed a ban on detainees coming to the United States for any reason, whether it was to be imprisoned or to go to trial. And so I think, or to be detained. And so I think that if he had understood the partisan nature of the Guantanamo issue, he would have brought it to a close much more quickly, and then dealt with some of the issues about releasing detainees, trying detainees after they were here.
But there certainly were Democrats that also opposed the release of Guantanamo detainees into their either states or into their districts. So it really was, in many ways, not partisan, but a bipartisan effort to stop this.
Right, and that I think goes to another issue, which is how do we have leadership in this country that's willing to take a stand that says, you know, we can be safe, in particular when it comes to people that we have in custody. So the idea that the detainees would have posed some kind of threat to the United States, especially if they were in prison here, it just seems to me something in which there was a lot of lack of leadership from the president on down. And look, when the detainees were first brought after 9/11, within months after 9/11, to Guantanamo Bay, the military families there were given a choice on whether to stay and keep their families there when they were told the worst of the worst were coming. So imagine that atmosphere, and they decided as a group to stay. So they trusted law enforcement and the authorities and the military to keep them safe, even among detainees that they were told were the worst of the worst. So it's about leadership and education and learning to trust our security in this country, and we haven't had enough of it.
But what is really bizarre is that terror suspects have been tried in American courts. They've been convicted. They've been sent to American prisons. Excuse me. So why not Guantanamo detainees?
It depends on who you talk to. So there are a couple of reasons. One is that one Guantanamo detainee was brought to this country for trial in 2010. His name was Ahmed Gailani. He was one of what your last guest referred to as the high-value detainees who had been detained at a CIA black site, who was associated with accused of lethal bombings and deaths that include Americans, namely the embassy bombings attack of 1998. And he was accused on 284 counts, because each of the murders of the over 200 people were among the charges. And he was acquitted on all but one charge. And it was seen as a test case for the rest of the high-value detainees at Guantanamo. And given that he was convicted on only one charge, even though on that charge he was sentenced to life, he at the Supermax in Colorado, it sent a sign of panic throughout a good part of the American Congress and public, that this was not an outcome that they had expected, and it was too close to a full acquittal. So that's one big reason, just psychologically and operationally, that the rest were not brought here, because I think Eric Holder, then Attorney General at the time, was hoping this would pave the way for the others to come here. But the real issue at Guantanamo has to do with, and the trials, the military commissions, has to do with the way in which torture plays into these cases. So you take the 9/11 case. These five defendants were held at CIA black sites. They were tortured. Therefore, a lot of the evidence against them doesn't exist outside of tortured confessions or tortured statements. So the witnesses, the evidence, and the individuals themselves all have some relationship with torture. And this, too, is a problem, and it was a problem in the Gailani case that went through the federal courts as well. So it's a murky issue.
The New York Times reported this week that the administration is in talks to transfer as many as 17 or 18 of these detainees held at Guantanamo either to Italy or Oman, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates. And obviously, at its height, Guantanamo held, I think, as many as 800 detainees. If these people are released and accepted into these countries, who's left at Guantanamo?
So the couple dozen that will be left at Guantanamo, taking the military commissions individuals aside and those who are about to be released aside, will be individuals who are in a category that Carol Rosenberg, reporter from the Miami Herald, called forever prisoners or forever detainees. And those individuals are considered too dangerous to release, but the United States does not have enough evidence to try them. And so they've been kept in this category, which is a new category for the United States, of being held in detention without access to due process, without access to a trial, without access to either being charged or released. And so those are these individuals that both President Bush and his administration and President Obama and his administration have decided are too dangerous to release. And so the issue of closing Guantanamo has always not really been closing Guantanamo. Neither president has thought about ending this category of indefinite detention. So the country as a whole has moved towards closing the facility, but not really towards the idea of getting rid of this category of those who are held without release and without charge.
And is it also a complicating factor in that it also feels like we're in a war without end, this quote-unquote war on terrorism that seems to continue apace?
It's a hugely complicating factor, particularly legally, where law and war are combined in a way that makes people on both sides of the issue uncomfortable. And now, as the terrorism around the world, it becomes more heightened in terms of threat level, and we have the threat of ISIS, you really have to wonder about the future of Guantanamo. Donald Trump has said he'd like to keep it open and expand it. There has been no new detainee brought to Guantanamo Bay Detention Facility since 2008.
Hmm.
So this would be a marked turn in our affairs, our detention affairs. And also, you know, you started the program, this segment of the program, by playing President Obama's thoughts in 2008 about closing Guantanamo. And yet here we are, and the cost of keeping it open may be that it actually could expand.
Explain what you mean by that. The cost of keeping it open would expand it?
The fact that we've kept it open means that it's there for new detainees to come in. And, you know, that is just something that was not thinkable during the Obama administration and not even at the end of the Bush administration. So the fact that they would add individuals to Guantanamo Bay, who would they be, under what authorization? But it is something that President-elect Trump has mentioned.
Well, in fact, he has even indicated, I believe in one comment or one talk somewhere, that those detainees could be American citizens if they had some kind of tie to ISIS, for instance.
Yes, he did. And this has been a recurrent theme throughout the discussion of where should these individuals, these defendants, be held and where should they be tried. And for the most part, that conversation has revolved around foreigners, foreign terrorists who are brought to this country, very, very few in recent years. So there have been pundits and politicians who have said they should go to Guantanamo Bay. But more concerning is the idea that individuals like the Boston bombers, for example, might have been put, even though they aren't, were American citizens, into Guantanamo Bay. And so this would be opening up a whole new category of possibilities. Since the very beginning of the war on terror, there has been a clear line. If you were an American citizen, you could not be in Guantanamo Bay. So yes, this is concerning and new.
Let's get some callers and comments into the conversation, talking with Karen Greenberg. She's the head of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School, wrote a book earlier this year, and I have it right here, and it's called Rogue Justice. Let me get Alex from Wilmington, Delaware, to join us. Alex, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
I had a question regarding Obama's use of drones and his use of drones as opposed to trying to capture people. It seems like instead of trying to capture people and perhaps detaining them or, you know, doing enhanced interrogation / torture, he's just killing them with missiles. How is that any more legal or preferable as a technique to address counterterrorism or to go forward with that system?
Alex, thanks for the question. Yeah. Karen, go ahead.
Yeah, that is just such an excellent question, and it goes to the heart of the matter. One of the things that President Obama said he would do at the outset of his presidency was come up with a rational, transparent detention policy. In fact, they didn't really do that. Instead, they shifted, as the caller said, to not detaining people, but to identifying them threats through intelligence sources, putting a target on their head and using drones or missiles to kill them. And so we haven't really, the United States has not been detaining individuals. When we do capture them, instead of kill them, they're given back to the countries they're in. To detain or to try or to let go. And so it's a very good question that the evolution, one way to say this is that the evolution of the detention policy became the targeted killing policy, which is murky. We don't really have a lot of transparency about what the criteria are. It's trust me government. And the problem with trust me government, trust the president and his advisors to make this decision based on their knowledge of the facts, is that you don't know who's going to be in charge and what their definition of the criteria and the enemy are.
Alex, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Picking up on that, Karen, President Obama's use of drones, is that under the Authorization for Use of Military Force, AUMF, which was agreed to after the September 11th, the use of force against those who, quote, planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th? Is that under this authorization that he feels entitled to use drones?
Yes, and also in part under, you know, further evolutions of the policy of identifying the enemy. So you just read, you know, it was those who were responsible for 9/11, those who supported them, etc. Over time, what's happened, and this applied first to detention policy and now to targeted killing, is this notion of associated forces, so that it's not just the hot battlefield necessarily. It's also, or Al-Qaeda central, it's Al-Qaeda elsewhere, and ISIS and other foreign terrorist organizations. And so this has sort of been a growing category under the AUMF. As you know, there have been numerous calls for getting a new AUMF that is more appropriate to the breadth of the targets geographically and otherwise that have been detected in the last few years. And that's a discussion that may very well come up under the Trump administration.
Here's an email from Mike. He says, if these torture techniques have been conducted by other governments like Russia, would we consider those leaders to be war criminals? Karen?
Yeah, I mean, under international law, the torture is considered a war crime, and criminal and a war crime under laws of war. And so, yes, we would consider them to be war criminals. And I think that many people feel that way about the people who authorized and conducted torture on behalf of the United States, particularly as it was done as a secret policy that, for the most part, has not been determined to have given us very much, and which violated fundamental laws and constitutional principles in the United States, aside from international law.
We're almost out of time here. I mean, President Obama said said that as president, he was going to stop the torture. That was his word. Do we still torture people? Do we know?
To our knowledge, we do not torture people. I'm sure there are individuals who are, you know, holding people at Guantanamo Bay without any access to justice is one kind of torture. But in actual fact, the kind of torture that was talked about with enhanced interrogation techniques during the Bush administration is something that we don't as a country do. And most importantly, it is not the law of the land like it was considered to be prior to President Obama. So the answer to that is no, we don't.
Well, Karen, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
And thank you for having me.
You're welcome. That's Karen Greenberg. She's the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School, the author of a book called Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. And we began our conversation with Sherry Fink, a correspondent at The New York Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.